in the limelight.
In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As US forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jonathan N.G. Arthur. This article is published under the heading, Covert US Operations in Africa are Sowing the Seeds of Future Crises. Stay tuned for more. This March, Malian forces attacked Moura, a small sun-baked town in the middle of the country. The operation began on a market day, as locals streamed into the area with their livestock. Residents recall hearing helicopters slash the air and soldiers disembark with grim resolve. Malian forces laid siege to the village for multiple days, reportedly slaughtering civilians and wreathing corpses in flames. In a clinically worded communique, the government announced that army completed a systematic cleaning of the zone with very precise intelligence, killing 203 militants. Immediately, investigators contested its account, Human Rights Watch labeling the operation the worst atrocity in Mali's decade-long armed conflict. Estimates of civilian deaths range as high as 500. Another episode in a litany of atrocities. The United Nations has urged investigation of the latest scandal in Mali's war against militants. Yet the massacre also signifies the failure of the United States policy as Mali occupies the center of U.S. strategy in Sahel region. Since 2007, U.S. Africa Command, that is AFRICOM, has vigorously partnered with the states to combat militants, bolster influence, and check competitions there. Rather than secure peace, U.S. intervention has internationalized local conflicts, deepened social divisions, and fostered militarism. Its failure has profound roots. Malian crisis and other conflicts are inseparable from a cascading history of U.S. interventionism in Africa. AFRICOM policy directly builds on the Cold War. After the Second World War, the U.S. discreetly promoted Western retrenchment in Africa. Officials helped Europeans reassert colonial mastery in order to forge a unified capitalist bloc and support for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They notably armed France during its bitter war in Algeria, which became emblematic struggle for colonialism. But as the conflict drained Western legitimacy, U.S. policymakers encouraged Europeans to substitute informal hegemony for territorial occupation. Paradoxically, a new imperial order emerged with decolonization. Western capitals maintained effective sovereignty through a balance of soft and hard power. The haze of ideology, capital markets, political pressure, military bases, and other tools that could plunge a former colony into chaos. Lacking comparable tools in Africa, the U.S. initially outsourced imperialism to European allies. Yet gradually, the U.S. cast a searing shadow backing coups to smother radicalism, open markets, and combat influence. The The Democratic Republic of Congo first felt its weight in 1960. U.S. officials regarded the country as a subterranean treasure trove brimming with strategic minerals. Yet they viewed its first prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, with acute anxiety. Lumumba refused to accept Western hegemony while celebrating Congolese independence as a decisive step towards the liberation of the entire African continent. President Dwight Eisenhower wished he would fall into a river full of crocodiles. That summer, he schemed to assassinate Lumumba and install a pliant substitute. The CIA deemed his removal an urgent and prime objective. Eventually, secessionists compelled Lumumba to request UN intervention. Yet, as the historian Elizabeth Schmidt observes, the operation was largely an American affair. The U.S. ferried UN troops to the Congo while snatching power from Lumumba. After he thwarted their grasp, the CIA helped local officials apprehend him. They handed Lumumba over to secessionists, who brutally murdered him before an approving audience of Western observers. Lumumba's assassination was a cruel premonition. In following years, U.S. leaders ruthlessly eliminated exponents of African liberation. They especially targeted Kwame Nkrumah, an elegant colossus of Pan-Africanism. After Lumumba fell, Nkrumah warned that neocolonialism threatened to subvert African independence, reducing states to shells directed from outside. Nkrumah turned Ghana into a bastion of revolution, offering safe haven to anti-colonial movements and inspiring U.S. civil rights activists. In response, the U.S. State Department froze loans and depressed global prices, throttling Ghana's economy. Officers finally struck in February 1966. U.S. officials gloated that the new military government was almost pathetically pro-Western. In 1957, Ghana's liberation was the symbolic catalyst of African independence, lending decolonization an irresistible air of inevitability. By contrast, Nkrumah's downfall solidified an ominous trend toward military rule. Before 1965, coups were relatively rare. Within less than two decades, military leaders governed 40% of Africa. Ultimately, U.S. strategy curbed the promise of independence and accelerated the drift toward militarism, while carving the continent into invisible yet enduring spheres of influence. Repeatedly, U.S. partners waged catastrophic proxy wars across the region. Nkrumah's critique of neocolonialism proved prophetic. For those who practice it, it means power without responsibility, and for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. In 2020, the elaborate defense system imploded. That August, another U.S.-trained officer, Colonel Assimi Goïta, seized office in the Malian capital of Bamako, again citing the security crisis. His power grab initiated a wave of six groups in five countries within 2 years, immersing Mali, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, and Burkina Faso in chaos. AFRICOM had trained many of the plotters. In Guinea, local forces paused an exercise with U.S. Army Green Berets to storm the capital. Most coup leaders cited the threat of militants and poor governance, crises that AFRICOM had not solved but aggravated. Before 2001, U.S. officials registered no terrorist organizations in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2019, they tallied nearly 50. For years, AFRICOM had inflamed long-standing local conflicts, wrenching societies apart and lending militants meaning. And now, in a reverse domino effect, the very forces it enlisted to fight were rebelling. Tensions with Mali have compelled Western forces to scale back operations. This February, France announced troop withdrawals, while waning confidence in the West prompted local authorities to hire mercenaries. African Commander General Stephen Townsend warned that the decision would conclude in horrific violence against Africans. 2 weeks later, the Moro massacre unfolded. In the resulting fallout, Mali dissolved defense agreements with European allies this May while accusing France of espionage. The military junta then abandoned the G5 Sahel, prompting President Mohamed Bazoum of Niger to announce that the region's main security organization was dead. UN forces remain in Mali, sustaining heavy losses, investigating an exponential increase in human rights violations and defending an abrasive government that lacks control over the majority of its territory. Meanwhile, the UN warns that 18 million residents in the Sahel face severe hunger as war and famine sweep through the region. Yet the mounting crisis also implicates the U.S. AFRICOM regards itself as invisibly sleek and deadly effective, an elite force that fights tomorrow's wars today. But in practice, operations resemble previous neo-colonial interventions, fostering military rule and human rights violations. In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises.